Grace, greetings, and welcome to the Deeper Daily Podcast for the 24th of July. I'm your host, Paul White. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Today we begin working through the verses. We've done a couple of overviews, compared it a little bit with 2 Corinthians over the last couple of days. Before I do verse 1, I do want to give you one more possible connection to 2 Corinthians. It's in chapter 7. Paul says this in 2 Corinthians 7, verse 12, "Therefore, although I wrote to you, I did not do it for the sake of him who had done the wrong, nor for the sake of him who suffered wrong, but that our care for you in the sight of God might appear to you." And if this verse is an indication that Paul's referencing yet again our adulterous man, our sexually immoral man from 1 Corinthians 5, then Paul seems to be saying that I wrote not so much for that man who had done what was wrong, not so much for the people who suffered because of his wrong, but I brought it up so that you would know that I care for you. So it might help explain that this fifth chapter may not have near as much to do with Paul trying to discipline the man who has failed, or even to clean up the chaos that the man has caused in the life of, say, his father, which appears to be a possibility, but rather to let the Corinthian church know that Paul has fathered them and is willing to step into their mess and get his hands dirty. I say that because of the way the first verse lies in the text. I think this fifth chapter is as properly broken down into a chapter break as any spot in the book. You know me, I say sometimes, boy, I don't know why the translators didn't let you have one more verse or whatever. In this instance, this fifth chapter seems to stand alone as far as its subject matter, but that doesn't mean we can't benefit from finding out how the fourth chapter ends. So I want to take 1 Corinthians 4:21, which is the last verse of the previous chapter, and then read 5:1 back to back. See if it helps you to understand where Paul's going. Here's 4:21 and 5:1. "What do you want? Shall I come to you with a rod or in love and a spirit of gentleness? It is actually reported that there's sexual immorality among you, and such sexual immorality as is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife." Now, when you put those verses back to back, which Paul did, he didn't break it into chapters. He has a question. He asks a couple rhetorical questions. "What do you guys want? You want me to come to you with a rod, or do you want me to come to you in the spirit of in love and the spirit of gentleness?" And as we discussed a few days ago, the rod is not to destroy people or break legs or backs, but it is to tap people. It's a shepherd's rod. It's to tap you back into line. Now, it certainly can be used against the wolf or the lion or the bear, but he's not using it against the wolf. He's using it on Corinth. And it would appear that the rod is used as a disciplinary measure to sort of push you back onto the path. Again, not to smack you around. And in this context, what do you guys want? You want the rod, or you want love and spirit of gentleness? Let's deal with this issue. You guys have a sexually immoral man in your midst, and as we've said through the greater context, the issue is not so much that the man has failed. That doesn't seem to be Paul's indicator. The issue is verse 8. He's full of malice and wickedness, not sincerity and truth. So it's not about when people fail, you get rid of them. We're dealing with a man who is not sincere in his walk, does not accept the truth about who he is in his walk. He is full of malice. That's a deep-seated anger. And he's wicked. And so he's responding, or at least he's acting this way. He's responding this way to his fellow believers. And Paul has, it's been bad enough that Paul's heard about it. Now, verse 1, it's reported that there's a sexual immorality, the kind that's not even named among the Gentiles, seems to indicate that Gentiles don't even like to talk about it. It's a form of fornication with his stepmother, and we know that it's not his mother, it's his father's wife. Paul uses an interesting phrase that a man has his father's wife. That's a Hebrew form of expression for stepmother. Paul uses the Hebrew phrase instead of the ordinary Greek word here for stepmother. The ordinary, and maybe he does that. I read one commentator that I thought this was interesting, who said that perhaps Paul uses the Hebrew phrase for stepmother because that phraseology was a union with Moses' law, Leviticus 18, where you're not to sleep with your stepmother. And so Paul might use the Hebrew phrase so that his audience is reminded that God never liked that. It was never healthy for people to be engaged in this activity. And when you consider, in light of the fact that Paul's dealing with new creations, New Testament people, why is he bringing this up at all? Well, as we sort of unveil over the next few days the fullness of this chapter, it's pretty obvious the chaos that happens in this situation, the man that's affected, the father that's affected. But as we read in 2 Corinthians 7, it doesn't seem like Paul's writing it so much for that as much as he is the outlying chaos, the stuff that seems to be affecting the reputation of the Corinthian church and rubbing off on the Corinthian people in the way they're living. And so for that, Paul doesn't have much quarter. He doesn't have much room for that sort of activity when it seems to be so embraced to the point that they're arrogant. And you are puffed up. You are arrogant and have not rather mourned that he who has done this deed might be taken away from you. And that is sort of a glorying in present condition, sort of glorying in what you are, even though there should be some sorrow. There should be some humiliation a little bit. There should be some self-abasement. There should certainly be some humility. I mean, we have something pretty big going on in our midst, and we should probably be less arrogant that everything is okay. And I think it's important for us as people of grace to realize that while Paul doesn't act as if this man is lost, in fact, he says we'd rather his flesh be consumed so that his spirit is saved. Paul never indicates the man's not a brother. He never indicates the man's not a believer. He never indicates the man's not in the hand of the Lord. But Paul's concern is that what the man is doing is so dangerous that it's hurting the reputation and the lives of the other believers. And we in grace need to be maybe a little more serious about protecting the body at large when we see people in blatant sin who have the attitude this man had in the eighth verse. He's not sincere, he's not truthful, he's got malice, and he's wicked. To me, that's a far cry different, however, because I get people arguing, you know, against grace to say you guys don't preach on sin enough. And my thought is, well, you can preach on, people know what sin is. You can preach on sin all you want. What are you going to say about it? Don't do it, and if you don't do it, you're right with God, and if you do it, you're wrong with God. So a lot's going to depend on how you handle it. But at the same time, you're dealing with believers who are failing. Where that needs to be dealt with corporately, to me it would seem, is those believers who live a lifestyle not sincere and not full of truth, who are wicked and malicious, and who by doing so bring shame upon the entire body. That does need dealt with in the Grace Church. How can it not be? Paul seems to deal with it here. We'll move on to the third verse, or I'll deal a little more with the second verse also tomorrow. I'll see you then. God bless.